We have the diehards.
Woo! Survived. Who is here for all three? I should know your names by now. So. Give yourself a hand of applause.
Exactly.
You made all three.
You made it. Here.
So we are up against software-defined networking management and tools across the ways there. Something about direct access, modern remote access technologies over there. And another one is, I don't know, something else. This is the most interesting one. This is server. This is file servers and storage options. In case you were not one of the six people that were in the room that were here last time, my name is Rick Claus. I'm a senior technical evangelist with Microsoft. And I'm joined by a good friend and colleague of mine.
It's Joey Stowe. I'm also a senior technical evangelist. You can find us both on the Twitters. You see our Twitter handles are up there. We're also not hard to find.
On Facebook, LinkedIn.
Sure.
So it's our job to basically be approachable, accessible, and geeky enough that you want to come and talk to us at all times.
So this is part three of a three-part series. If you weren't here for the first two, it's okay.
They are recorded.
They're recorded. Available. You can watch them.
Yep.
We'll get you caught up to speed. It's very simple. We started with a mixed 2003-2008 environment. We've upgraded all of our domain controllers. We've upgraded core network services like DHCP. We actually just migrated them over.
You got it.
We added some IPAM in to do some IP address management.
Right.
And now...
We talk about the big, gnarly, fun stuff with file servers.
I thought we were done.
No, we got some more stuff to do. But you know what? Before we actually even continue on, I do want to say, can you, for the people in the room, round of applause for the lovely ladies doing security in the doors here in the environments.
Yeah, well done.
Bellissimo. Grazie. And then also for the AV guys in the back to making us sound good and the projectors, thank you very much for you as well.
Yeah.
Because they are here way longer hours than we are to make us look good and sound good, which is good.
Yes. Nice transition.
I know. I have to get at least two cheesy transitions in for all my sessions, and that's all I have. Otherwise, it just straight fades for where it is.
All right, so for those of you who have been here through the other two sessions or one of the other sessions, you may doze off for exactly 1 minute, 30 seconds while we cover and bring the rest of everybody up to speed.
They might not wake up, though. Like, don't say that.
Okay, you cannot doze off. You can check email. Hurry. All right, so we have a survey. Now, this is not a Gartner, Forrester.
IDC.
No, it's a Rickster CDN survey that we did where we asked, what part of your IT infrastructure are you most concerned with upgrading? And the survey says?
Primarily, it's all workgroup servers that are running different types of application servers on top of them because they are rather unique. Each one has its own way of having to be upgraded, particular to the type of workload that's on top of it from application perspective. We already covered off the Active Directory. We already covered off networking infrastructure as well. That leaves us with actually, and interestingly, letter B, the smallest number of respondents, 9, came back and said that they're the most concerned with upgrading their infrastructure to file servers. Further diving into it a bit more, it could be possibly because you may have taken advantage of one of the phenomenon, that talks about massive storage filers and tiered storage and access to simple SMB shares using Active Directory authentication, stuff like that, as if it was a server of SAN infrastructure, and you just kind of put it up there and you're just done with it. You don't want to think about it. You just buy more drives and you keep on buying more drives and it's done, like a file, like a NetApp or something like that. Or it could be that you simply have such a large and massive amount of files that you just don't even want to begin to think about what's involved for migrating them, and you really should go ahead and do this. And this is where I'm, again, going to be challenging your preconceived notions about virtualization versus physical servers.
Well, now after we had lunch in the last session and we talked about it, I'm warming up to the idea of virtualizing my DCs,
right,
particularly with VMGen ID. Okay, I can't screw it up.
Just don't do like we were doing and bringing them up and down and rebooting them and stuff in fast succession before they got finished replicating.
And then snapshot and roll them back.
You got it.
So with file servers, I've approached file server migrations several times in my career working in IT. And every time I go in to do a file server migration, I go in with the world's best intentions. I'm going to clean it up. We're going to get rid of all of these groups and permissions and everything else. We're going to know who has access to our data.
You're going to simplify.
We're going to get rid of the 100 copies of the different files that are all
the
same.
Executive memos and that sort of stuff.
Right, yeah. The executive memos. By show of hands, how many of you have actually accomplished said task?
Oh, we have one.
One person. Congratulations,
because here's
sir.
What happens. I get about a month and a half into it, and I finally go, you know what? I'm done. I'm just moving it all. We'll deal with it later. I can buy more storage. It's cheap. Right?
No, it's not. I don't know. Where are you buying your storage? Storage isn't cheap. We did a follow-up survey about what kind of file servers are you guys running inside your organization, the bulk of which, I'm pleased to see, half of them are probably in the 2008 R2 range as far as your file servers are concerned. A smaller portion, only 3% of the unofficial survey results, came up with some kind of a filer thingamajiggy for their response. There was a higher number of NASs out there, which is interesting. And then
I'm a little worried about the one respondent that said, files, we don't need no stinking files.
Yeah, I guess he just uses, or she just uses some network cloud storage thing, and they just surf the web or something like that. But there's a small number of you that are still using 2003 R2. Hopefully that's not the case. Behind the scenes for all of this, for what you should see, is the prevalent nature of the SMB protocol versions that I'm looking at here. I'm looking at version 2, 2.1, 2.2, 3.0. Three different versions, four different versions of SMB on this slide right now that your clients could be using if they're Windows-based, not to mention if they are Mac-based or if they are Linux-based or whatever it happens to be. We're just talking about the basics as far as what's out there. Interestingly enough, we have been participating with the industry that works in storage to try to standardize and also work with in those standards by the different bodies to create things like SMB3 as an example, which other people are free to be able to go off and to use, and other people are adopting. NetApp has an availability of an SMB3 plugin for their NetApp filer to be able to accept SMB3 requests. SMB3 is the panacea of where you are trying to get to because of its multi-session awareness, because of its sheer raw throughput, with its offloading, with its ODX transfer, RDMA, offloading CPU capabilities, XYZ, ABC, 123. It's got all the different bells and whistles that the next generation of files and services require. So this session is basically going to get you up to that most current version as best as you can to be able to take advantage of that. Now, we're again talking about 2012. We're not going to be talking about 2012 R2. A good friend of mine, Jose Barreto, is a guy that you should have listened to, and if you have not had a chance to, go back to the Channel 9 website, go to events for TechEd Europe, Madrid, do a speaker filter on Jose, and watch every single one of his sessions, because they're all phenomenal. He's so intensely deep, but at the same time, able to express very complex things in a very simple way and still stay very, very technical. And he goes in glorious depth about SMB3, what you can do with it as a workload, and tiering and all sorts of goodness that is that sort of thing. So we're going to be talking about 2012 in this environment here. But the file servers, again, a lot of you, as Joey's story started off with, were like, I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to leave it as it is, mainly because it's the workhorse in your stables that just keeps on humming and chomping away as your users go off and access files. Typically, you'd think of a file server when you start to be coming too close to its storage capacity and you need to expand upon it, or if you are trying to save space by deduplication of some kind, or that you're going off and possibly making it more highly available or migrating it to one of these kind of filer kind of things. You don't think about it until things don't work. Next to email, I would say it's probably one of those things that most office environments are probably the most concerned with, is making sure they have access to their files and their knowledge that's in there. So definitely very important server that often gets neglected. And you can tell by the generation 2, I think, of these particular HP servers that are on the screen there. This guy hasn't touched his file server in quite some time.
Those look like my file servers.
Yeah. You could probably have the same processing power now on about not even half of a U on those systems. And so some thoughts on this particular thing. When's the last time you thought about touching and managing your file server? It simply goes off and serves up some files. Potentially, you're in the same boat as a lot of people where it is your last physical boxes that are kicking around because of just raw throughput of having access to your SAN or access to your network attached storage. It may be one of your last physical boxes that is out there. And then also, as I mentioned, often overlooked for possible upgrades of newer technology that's out there.
So this is kind of where I have to kind of hold Rick back. This is one of his absolute favorite topics of discussion. If you happen to corner Rick at one of the social events or something, and If you even say the word storage, be prepared to be standing there for about an hour.
You start giggling.
Because he gets uber excited. So I'm just going to tee it up for you now.
Okay.
Why Windows Server 2012 when it comes to storage? Because as you've mentioned, yeah, there's not been a lot of innovation. I don't know why I need to be upgrading.
Main thing is, as you probably saw in the keynote, this is again 2012, not 2012 R2. Saw in the keynote, there's some definite major stuff you want to look at from a 2012 R2 perspective, which we'll talk about in a moment. But even just from 2012, it has the abstraction of storage by using this thing called storage spaces. And it's actually catching on quite well with the industry and also with customers wanting to use it. Next to virtualization, storage spaces is one of the primary drivers we're seeing for why Server 2012 is being implemented, is because of storage spaces. I always get questions when we talk about storage spaces, is this the replacement for my SAN? Do I throw my SAN out? And the answer is, well, does it still work for you? Do you still have space on it? Is it performant enough for you? Do you got enough headroom? If you answered yes to those questions, then absolutely, keep it. Don't do anything with it. Keep on using it. You can re-architect it a little bit, possibly, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But this is not something I'm just recommending, go out lock, stock, and barrel, or replace all your SANs with storage spaces. I'm not recommending that. There's definite advantages for having SAN technology still out there. But think about this for new projects. We're in the workroom for the team here, and we also work on Channel 9. You might have seen us in such famous TV shows as the Tech Ed Countdown Show. Well, as you can imagine, a recorded high-definition version of a 75-minute talk here at Tech Ed takes up about 300 and some odd gigs. Multiply that by 500 and some odd sessions, multiply that by five different conferences a year. We got a lot of storage. And we store that up on Azure, and we access it through Azure and through content delivery networks. But sometimes you might want to have an offline local copy of it as well from an archive perspective because you don't need it anymore. You can get enterprise-class storage or SAN-like capabilities with a storage space and direct-attached storage with as good, if not better, throughput than direct-attached storage using storage spaces and commodity hardware, JBODs, just a bunch of disks, based on how you want to architect it. Still going to be pricey because, you know, disks are expensive and network connectivity has to be properly designed, but storage spaces is a huge, viable option, and I'll delve into it more in the upcoming section here.
And in the box.
And in the box. Doesn't cost you anything. Inbox deduplication is probably the second biggest thing that I see a lot of people interested in. As soon as you get your files up on top of a 2012 server and not on a filer, not on some of the older systems that are out there, in the box, as long as it's on NTFS, you can turn on deduplication. Do not turn it on 2012 if those happen to be VHDX files or VHD files or database files like SQL databases and stuff. Not designed for that. It's designed for your commodity, everyday information worker, office documents. Yes, sir. Yes, good question. So the comment was, you can turn it on for VHDs and VHDXs. Look at that. You made her run all that way. Yeah. So you absolutely can turn it on, but only for offline, not in use VHDX files and ISO files and stuff like that from a library perspective because you don't want them doing anything. In 2012 R2, you're good to go to have them on if they're live and ready to go. So inbox deduplication, phenomenal stuff. It literally is a ticky box you have to turn on, and that's it. So the question does the ability exist for you to mark areas, folder structures, or other things as non-deduplicated on a drive so it doesn't happen? The answer is no. It's on a per-volume basis. So it's either on or it's off on a per-volume drive letter basis for the way you have to think about this. SMB3, that's what I used to call before R2 came out, the fire-breathing dragon feature of Server 2012 besides Hyper-V. Because of SMB3 for its sheer raw throughput, speed, phenomenal stuff you can do with it. It is absolutely the cat's meow for what you can do with simple file transfers between servers that are 2012 and between Windows 8 clients and the Windows server that's out there. SMB multi-channel is amazing. It gets even better with the next version of it, which technically I think is SMB 3.01 or something like that, according to the specs. Jose will tell you what the proper one is. it gets even better with R2. NIC teaming in the box is something I don't directly talk about here, But the ability to go through and take those multiple nicks on the back of your server and eliminate one of the highest causes of network server downtime inside your environment, failed nick cards or mismanaged cable management of nicks on your servers. You now have Inbox, without the need of third-party software, ability to go through and team those guys together into a single individual nick. And then finally, scale-up file server. Important to note, in case you kind of get lost in all the hype, like I was, because I love file server, and I'm not going to say hype, lost in the excitement, I guess you would say, is the fact that the scale-up file server is designed for workload. It's not designed optimally for what you want to use for your information workers, office documents, and home directories. Your scale-up file server is designed for something that's going to be compute-intensive, for being able to handle multiple sessions that are open to very large VHD and VHDX files, and or SQL databases that support SQL on top of this as well, SQL 2012. Those are your optimal ways of going stuff for 2012. And yes, as it is on every single one of the slides I talk about, it is your easiest path to Windows Server 2012 R2.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Yeah, this is where I get lost. I just love this stuff. So
I'm going to put a timer on you. Watch my Surface. There is a timer on you.
Okay, I'm going to try to keep this in time.
Okay.
The concept of storage spaces has not changed from 2012 to 2012 R2, except there are some additional new features. What it does, quite simply put, is it takes direct attached storage or shared attached storage, like shared SAS drives, USB connected storage, although not recommended on your servers to use USB. It works, but I don't recommend it. It takes a variety of different size disks and then abstracts them from the operating system in pools. And prior to R2, you would basically categorize those pools based on characteristics of the disk for performance. This would be my faster 15,000 RPMs. These are my slower 7200s that are larger in capacity. These are my super fast and expensive SSD drives, as an example. That's how you would probably want to go off and choose your pools. They don't have to be the same connectivity mechanism. They don't have to be the same disk size. They abstract them together for a particular purpose of being able to identify this is a pool of the system. You then layer on top of that a storage space. That storage space comes in the point of view of what's known as a virtual drive. That virtual drive allows you to lay down the data across those individual abstracted disks in a format way that's either going to have no redundancy, simple, parity, or mirrored, and a two-way mirror or a three-way mirror. Don't think of this as your grandfather's RAID 1 or RAID 5 for the way you used to do it with your old PERC controllers. This is now you're taking amounts of data that are slabs of data and painting them across different drives, so you can actually make mirrors with different size drives because you're painting the data in slabs across two different size drives to do it. You also have the ability to do anywhere from one drive failure with minimum two disks to two drive failure with five. Did I do that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Three-way mirror with five disks for the way that it handles it. The neat thing about this as well is as your virtual disk starts to run out of space, because you can thin provision it if you wanted to, all you have to do is simply go through and add more drives to the pool, and then you can extend and expand the actual space available within your virtual disk. The virtual disk is, again, simply laying down how the data is going to happen inside the system. Then it gets exposed up to and is leveraged by all the different services that are on Windows Server. Your file server, Hyper-V, SMB Direct, SMB Multichannel, even NFS if you wanted to, clustered shared volumes, failover clustering. Basically, all the other components of Windows Server 2012 take advantage of this. They all use and are presented basically a volume, a drive letter, as far as where they actually go off and they get used. And then finally, from the last piece of scale, you have the ability to set these guys up in a fashion where you have multipath I.O., and shared access to the same set of drives to be able to have what's known as an application server known as a scale-up file server. Scale-up file servers handles up to 8 file systems and server CPUs. Now, just out of curiosity, do you know what's inside one of those big NAS boxes that you pay a lot of money for that has, besides a bunch of blinky lights and drives, you know what else is in there? Controller / PCs. You know what the controller is? A couple of Xeon processors, a bunch of RAM, a bunch of disk, and a whole bunch of memory for cache, and then controller cards. That sounds an awful lot like a server, doesn't it? Now, layered on top of this, when you have volumes, is you have the ability to go through with NTFS only at this point in time, unless you're talking R2, the ability to go through and do deduplication. And the deduplication algorithm basically will go through and provide you space back to your operating system. And if you're doing this on 2012 and you have an operating system or a hypervisor, like a workload, that understands trim commands, you can actually return space back to the pool dynamically to make it available for other areas. So basically, on a VHD library, you could get up to about 80% consolidation of space because of the operating systems in the library having a lot of the same binaries. Software deployment share, same kind of thing. General file share, you're looking at about 40 or whatever it happens to be. The neat thing about this is there's a utility called dedupeval or ddpeval.exe on server 2012. You can simply run that against the machine to be able to see how much space would I save if I went ahead and started to do deduplication. Deduplication happens with some very simple parameters that allows you to choose how long the data has to be at rest without being changed before it's considered for deduplication. And then it'll go ahead and start the deduplication on a scheduled basis after that point. Obviously, very volatile files like my home folder and my docs, stuff like that, you don't gain that much, but you still get some place, some space. That's in there. So that's architecturally a lot of stuff. Why don't I just kind of show them a bit, I guess, eh?
Sure, absolutely. So let's level set where we're at now with our environment. Now, through this, the last couple of sessions I mentioned, we've upgraded, gotten rid of our 2003 domain controllers. We've gotten rid of our 2003 DHCP and network services that we've had going on. We now have this beast of a file server sitting around. Is it 2008, I believe?
We have a 2008 box that currently has a whopping 150 megs worth of files.
That is a lot of files.
We're trying to make this fast for the demos.
Yes, exactly. So we are now, we're very close to having our entire infrastructure, at least those lights on, or you call it dial tone services, moved off.
Yeah.
So we've got some file systems that we've got here. We've got some DFS that's going to have to be moved.
Yep.
As well, and migrated over. And the tool set that we use to migrate, and that we're going to actually use to migrate some of this stuff, we're going to use all inbox. So there's nothing that you can't get for free. We're going to start off again, and we're going to leverage the migration tools that we talked about. They're the same tools that we used in our last session for DHCP. In fact, we're actually going to use the same commands to actually get them up and running. What we have done, in the interest of time, in getting all of this whopping 165 meg of data moved over, is we've actually ensured that we have all of the features added. So the file server migration tools, or the Windows Server migration tools, are part of Windows Server 2012. We've gone ahead and added that feature, and we're ready to move forward.
Right. So the first part here, this is my 2012 file server -1. It's simply a member server right now. If I take a look at it, you can see it has no drive except for the one guy that's there that's available. And if I actually go into my management tool, you can go ahead and take a look under file services and storage services. That I have under storage pools, currently nothing. It's just sitting there waiting. I have three available disks that I can add in to my particular storage space. Likewise, as well, if I look under volumes, this is kind of neat because it actually shows me across all my selected servers that are available how my volumes are available as far as space is concerned, if they have a lot of free space or not. I actually would get a warning message on my dashboard if I'm starting to get too close to my upper level maximums that are there. So with these disks that are available down here at the bottom, I've got 327 gigabytes sample VHD files. They look like they're iSCSI disks that are there, SCSI disks that are there waiting to be connected in. I go and simply say new storage pool. It's a wizard interface. This could be done for my Windows 8 machine using RSAT back at my desk. I don't have to be in the server room to do this. And I'm going to give this guy a name. Very simplistic storage pool number 1. I could, you know what, let's actually make this something different. Let's go off and call this my gold storage. Let's say this happens to be very fast SSD drives as an example. Choose the devices that I want to include. And obviously, I'm going to choose them all. I could go off and change my allocation from automatic to being a hot spare. Simply, they don't get used for quantity of content. They can be used to be brought in case a drive happens to fail automatically for me. I'm going to leave them all simply as automatic.
So, Rick, when you're creating a storage pool and you're going through trying to decide how to carve it up.
Yeah.
What are some of those design considerations that you really want to focus in on?
With 2012, it literally is simply a matter of what's the bus connecting to the drives and how fast is the drive spinning. That's the easiest way to think of how you want to make your 2012 pools. If you're running 2012 R2 in release preview in your labs, and you have mixed drives that are in here, here's your thought process on how this works. What it does is it looks and evaluates the metadata of the drive, interrogates it, and finds out, does it have a spindle speed, yes or no? If it does, regardless of what it is, that's considered the slow drive. If it is a zero spindle speed, that means it's SSD, which means it's a fast drive. So basically, it'll say, oh, I detected out of these 75 drives, 12 of them were SSDs, and the rest of them were other stuff. What do you want to do? Do you want to make a tier out of this? In which case, you allocate so many of the SSDs into the tier for your high performance. All the rest of them go off into another guy, and that's basically how you set up tiered storage in 2012 R2. I don't have that option, so I would have to actually go in here and manually know these drives are this speed and this size, and I want to group them together in that fashion.
So you're grouping these together just based on, hey, let's pretend these are 15,000 RPM drives for storage.
Yep, you got it. But I actually call them gold, so I think they're probably SSDs.
Oh, they're probably SSDs because you call it gold. All right.
Now, this is actually kind of neat if you've never made this before. The ability to what's known as chain your wizards together, the ability to basically say the next logical step after you simply make your pool is go ahead and make your disk. Built in, turn on the checkbox, hit close, it kicks off the next wizard. Next wizard comes back and says, okay, this is the pool. Currently, they have available space inside of it. All you did was simply group them by performance. Let's go off and lay down a format on top of that. This one here is going to be my mirrored space. And I'm going to choose a mirror. Now, another advantage, again, speaking of R2, is that we actually have write-back cache now available with R2. We did not have write-back cache on Parity. So performance-wise on Parity, it's not that great on a 2012 box. Mirror is going to be your fastest performing, but also your highest tax on cost, because every amount of disk that you have, basically, you only have half the capacity because of the mirror aspect of stuff. I'm going to do a mirror just to keep it simple. And then I like this here. Again, if you're used to working in SAN environments, you're probably familiar with this. I can make what's known as a thin provisioned or a fixed provisioning. If I do thin provisioning, I can basically fake it out and say that it is actually, that's not really just 378 terabytes or gigabytes. That's actually 10 terabytes. Type in 10, hit terabyte, hit OK, or next. Hit create, and it's done. But like my three-car garage, which is full of stuff, as opposed to my cars, which sit on the driveway, it will eventually fill up with stuff. So just make sure that you're aware that eventually, at about 80% capacity, you will get a warning message in your event log saying you're coming close to capacity, and you're going to want to go and add some more drives into that pool and then extend that virtual disk. Hit close. The last one comes up for your volume. The volume is where it actually appears as something usable by the operating system. Hit next. There it is, disk number 4. It's mirrored space. Notice how it says 10 terabytes. I could carve it up by partition, 10 terabytes. Give it a drive letter. Give it a data volume. You guys are aware of the severe performance hit that you get if you turn on generate 8.3s. I'm really hoping you don't have too many 16-bit operating systems that still need it. But do you remember the algorithm for that? Is it like 7 characters and a tilde and then the last character or something like that? I forget what it was.
I don't know.
I forcibly forgot that. So
yes.
Anyway, don't generate short file names. You're simply creating a lot of overhead. Don't need it. Hit create, hit done. And basically, I've now prepared my file server to receive the inbound data from my source, which is my 2008, I think I chose, 2008 file server. And if I take a look at it, under disks, there is my GPT formatted, it's a storage space, it's currently mirrored, and if I take a look at all my volumes, I'll see here that he is set up and ready to go, he's thin, he's good to go, and he's basically set up as a 10 terabyte drive. Done. Simple. That's how complex it is.
So now we've prepped our storage space.
Yep.
We've prepped our destination server. The next step that we've got to do is we actually now have to start looking at preparing. We're not actually going to move the data quite yet. We've got to prepare something else because we've got DFS and some other things that we want to add to this.
Yeah. So,
let's go ahead and get that set up.
Again, I love this tool. Simply a matter of going up here, manage add roles and features. File server is a role. Expand upon it, and you'll see that there is a bunch of stuff you can put in here. And I'm going to add in my file server, my DFS namespace, my DFS replication, and my file server resource manager. That basically brings up all the tools that I ever want to use on 2012, for the most part, on my new file servers. I'm going to talk about all of these choices here once I do a reboot, because a reboot will be required for these guys once I finish off the install. DFS. I'm assuming that you guys are using DFS in some way, shape, or form inside your environments. Is that a good assumption? People are using DFS?
Yes.
Who's not using DFS? Only a very small few are not using DFS. Think of what we're looking at from a cloud-based perspective. It sounds very marketing of us, but from a cloud-based perspective, we're abstracting processing power with virtualization as, you know, the highest level of one type of way of thinking of this. We're abstracting our storage with storage spaces. We're also able to go off and abstract namespace and IP addresses of shares to make things easier to migrate to and to migrate from, provided you start to use things like storage space, DFS namespace. So DFS namespace, what does it do? It hides the server name and makes it so it simply multiple naming servers can now respond to it to direct you to the proper UNC share. That now makes your data extremely portable between systems. You can slide things in without anyone having to worry about it. And you can replicate content down to a box. When it's done being replicated over a number of days or weekends, then you can make it live, right? So there's a lot of different options you can do with this type of an environment. So my file server just rebooted. File server 2012 version 1, there he is. Let's just go on and make sure he's all happy where he is, which he should be. So in this guy here, with my file space or namespace, let's go and take a look. I actually happen to have a corp.contoso.com/public. And of course, I put the slash in the wrong direction. And I don't know where these are. All I know is there's simply something I can map a drive to, and then I'll magically have access to the content of it. And if it ever happens to move, so long as I can query DFS and query Active Directory, I'll attach up to the closest copy as opposed to a single copy on a single server. So great stuff to be able to abstract your namespace that's in there. One thing that I have the ability to do is to go off and preserve some of my data, which is going off over here and using DFS util. DFS util is going to allow me to go off and to simply extract out who is responsible for those different namespaces for name servers and those individual kind of settings. So in this case, I'm going to simply say DFS util as a backup, a root of the thing. I want to do an export, and I want to use the namespace of corp.contoso.com/public. And I'm going to pipe that off and save it to dfsvack.txt. Done. That's basically backed up the information I need to have to worry about on that side of things. Now, that's basically all set. I'm ready to go and start, but I kind of want to talk a little bit about DFS from an architectural perspective for how we're going to move. I want to flip back the slides for that here.
Sure.
It's a blue slide. Oh, there we go. Did we miss one? No, we didn't. Okay. So picture this as an example. You basically have a server that is being configured currently as a hub, and it has two spokes on the end of it that are in branch offices, one particular type of DFS namespace. You could also simply have all of this located in one location, and you simply have it spread across multiple file servers, and they're simply replicating as a full mesh between them as another way of doing things. The idea is that basically, again, you've got your storage available on a SAN environment or some other location that's up there. What you're going to want to do basically is the same thing applies for 2008 R2 or for 2012. The idea is that you're bringing in a couple of new systems that are going to maintain the data of the DFS and brought in and replicate amongst the top level of the hub. And then it's going to go in, and eventually, once that's replicated and everybody's happy, because it's attached to the same SAN environment, we're going to unattach the original namespace server that's in there. And the clients aren't going to know this, any of this happened. The branch hubs in the other side of the replication configuration are also not going to know this happened as well, because we're doing this slowly to make sure that everything is all happy, to be able to make it all happen. So with that, let's go off and take a look at doing some, first of all, migration. With DFS namespace migration, the biggest issue that you're going to have is your data. 2 petabytes of data takes a long time to copy from point A to point B, and a lot of storage, right? So if you're talking a SAN environment, it's a heck of a lot easier. You simply attach a second setup to the same LUN, or you unattach it and you reattach to the new side. Basically, the SAN doesn't do any other sort of thing like that at all. That's a lot faster. Direct attached storage, a lot harder. You do have to figure out how to get the direct attached storage off of one guy over to the other guy in some way, shape, or form. If it's direct attached, potentially you could simply, literally, unattach it, move the drives, bring it up on the other side, and you're good to go, is one way of doing it. Or if you have the hardware, you could go off and push it over. And this is where I kind of look to you as an example, because you could virtualize it. If you virtualize it, you could also do possibly in place.
Sure.
Possibly as an option. A lot of people do virtualize their file servers as well, because it's easy enough to do. And you do have direct access to be able to attach up to LUNs and other things along those lines. We actually showed a demo last year at TechEd with simply having fiber channel cards exposed to the guest with virtual fiber channel with 2012 to be able to attach directly up to the SAN for massive throughput issues. And it's all fantastic for how that works. So one possible way of doing this, I'm not going to do it this way, but one way you can possibly do this is, and this was brought up to me, and it's kind of a mind bender. The file server team actually suggested, well, why don't you just virtualize it? Just do a P to V migration. Take a physical, do a physical to virtual migration in place. You have a virtual environment with enough storage to be able to do this, or you reattach the storage. And then you do, once it's migrated as a virtual instance on the old version of the OS, snapshot it, back it up to make sure it's all good, and then do an in-place upgrade. What's the advantage of doing an in-place upgrade with that amount of storage, that amount of complexity? Pardon me? You don't actually have to move anything. Correct. You don't have to move anything. And you don't have to reackle anything. And you don't have to worry about security descriptors being screwed up, because it's the same physical box, except now it's virtual, and then back it up, and then go off and upgrade it to the next version of the OS. If that doesn't work, you can revert your snapshot back. Mm-hmm. However, it's one of those last workloads people may or may not be comfortable virtualizing as of yet.
Well, it could also be a scenario, and this is kind of how I look at it here. We happen to be at 2008 now. But if I was running this file server workload on 2003...
With those Gen 2 HP servers that were on the first photo?
Yes, absolutely. I'm not really quite sure I'm comfortable in doing that. So in the future, yes, I'm just like what we did with Active Directory, I'm growing more and more comfortable with this virtualization. Mm-hmm. I need to get to a more modern platform so that when we get into this cycle of continuously updating, I can take advantage of things like with storage spaces and storage, essentially storage virtualization,
yep,
right, to be able to very rapidly move this up.
Yep. So something to consider as one path. As I mentioned in one of the earlier sessions, the direct in-place upgrade is actually one of the most tested scenarios that all the engineers and test paths have to go through at Microsoft during a software rev, and it possibly could save you an awful lot of heartache, although it is more risky because there is no backup plan that's easy enough to be able to go off and do. So next one up here, I'm actually going to flip back over to my demo, and I'm going to look at my old source server. You guys are familiar with these tools. Once again, these are the I've already launched up my my Windows PowerShell window for my migration tools. This is what should look familiar to you here. And I'm just going to go off here. And first of all, what's important on an old server? Well, if it's a server that's a file server, there's probably a whole bunch of local groups on that server that are going to have security descriptors inside of them, SIDs from global groups possibly, that are then protecting resources on that local box. So I've got to somehow migrate those local groups from the old box to the new box. That's what this tool is going to do. It's going to do that for me. So I'm just going to go in here and run export. Okay, it's the last session. Export. Tell me if I'm making any typos.
You got it, buddy.
SMIG server settings.
I love tab complete and PowerShell.
You got it, man. Group. Path that I want to do is to a /migration/data/groups. Verbose. Password to lock it up with. So this is going to look at the local SAM database of the machine, and it's going to go in and basically extract the information of all the groups that exist, the group memberships that exist, and store that inside a file for me, which I can then put on temporary storage, bring it into 2012, and run the reverse of this on the 2012 side. And it's coming. I like the little animation. It's very...
Yeah. I like watching dots on the screen.
Very 90s.
I'm sure the rest... Exactly.
Very
it's
90s.
PowerShell. Gotta love PowerShell. Gotta love PowerShell. So, another thing, too, is we've spent so much time pounding it into your heads, the way to properly ACL resources, right? Global groups, domain local groups.
AGLP.
Yeah, or AGDLP as we move forward. This is kind of key as to why we want to be able to capture these groups and move forward.
Yep. Now, again, I'm going to make sure that I have a copy of this sort of stuff over here, which is my 10.0.10.200 migration, and I got groups. And look, I did clear it out. I didn't clear out the last one. That was on my C drive, migration data, groups. There's my file. Copy that over to my temporary staging area. And basically, he's now done for the most part for what I need to do. Now, before I can import the data on the other side, I have to flip over to my 2012 box, server number one, which is right there. I'm going to fire up my migration tools because it was the main source extractor that I'm going to be using. And I'm going to use import SMIG server settings. I'm going to bring in my groups. Path I'm going to use, I'm actually going to cheat and go directly to the share. 10.0.10.200/migration/groups. We'll find out when
it's
I make
groups,
a typo.
It's plural.
And then verbose. Yep. Yep, found it. Password, unlock it. Bring it in. And I'll actually show you the groups that it creates that it found on the local box. Obviously, you can't run this on a domain controller for migrating your groups because that would just really, really mess things up.
And one thing to note with these migration tools, any of the built-in groups or anything, they're captured, but the migration tools knows that if they are built-in groups, so for instance, DHCP admins, whatever you want to call it, those groups won't be duplicated. In other words, they're not going to be recreated on the destination server. However, because they're built-in groups and the tool knows that it's a built-in group, if there are people that are members or other groups that are members of those groups, we'll go ahead and add those back in. Does that make sense? So you don't have to worry about copying the administrator group from one server to another and causing an issue. They're a built-in group. We're smart. We know what needs to be there. And actually, you're already seeing this, right?
There you go, look at this.
So you'll see it. It already exists. It already exists on the local computer. But that's okay, because if there was something inside of it, we're going to go ahead and include that in there.
So here's a local group that's called Modify Sales Local, as an example.
Yep.
That's now been recreated in the local box and is all set to go. And has global groups inside of it and that sort of stuff. Pretty simple for being able to bring the groups over. Now the groups are over. It's now duplicated. So now I can worry about getting the data over to this guy. And this is where you could use...
Send SMIG server data.
So you could use send SMIG server data and receive SMIG server data. You actually would do the receive first, lock it up with a shared secret, and then you would have to make sure that you had some TCP port, 7000 is the default, I think it was,
yep.
Open, TCP and UDP. I was talking to the file server guys, and really that's... Deprecated is the proper term?
Deprecated is the proper term, yes.
It's no longer the faster way to do things. So it's actually better to use a very complex tool, RoboCopy.
Fans of RoboCopy in the room.
You got it. corp.contoso.com/public And I want to, now the neat thing about me using, again, this abstracted version of the file share, I'm attaching to the closest copy of this data to bring it over to this box. I'm not just going to one server that's in Philadelphia. It's going to be the one that's here in Barcelona, as an example.
We're in Madrid.
But it's not here. It's in Barcelona.
Oh, gotcha. All right.
And so I was trying to go with
he
that.
He gets lost at times. It's okay.
I thought Teke was in Barcelona for the first 2 weeks of the countdown show. you have the source location, the destination location, /data is the share I want to go off and use. And then I want to make sure I do all subdirectories and retries and all empty subdirectories. And the most important switch is this one, sec, for the security descriptors. And if I typed it in correctly, according to my notes, there we go.
So now we're basically moving all of that over.
This is multi-threaded. By default, 9 threads or 8 threads are coming across through this copy of data. You don't necessarily want to do this during production hours.
Yep.
You might want to do this in stages over a period of time, provided you have space. You can set up synchronization that runs on a regular scheduled job. So you can do a big, massive batch at evenings and then catch up again during the day, only worried about change files and stuff like that. So there are a lot of good little tricks you can use to be able to make this guy work for you, to be able to do it. I'm pre-seeding my data, basically, by having this now done. So if I go back and take a look at this, on E Drive, under data, I have those same top-level folders on my local box now, which could be virtualized, could be physical. And I also have the ability to double-check and see here, under security, under sharing, that I have, for instance, here, a group, engineering, was referenced specifically on that ACL. So I know the ACLs came across as well. Robocopy also can obviously throw off a bunch of error messages and logging details if you wanted to make sure everything goes by and everybody's happy as well. So those guys are good. He's now happy and done. The last part that we have to worry about doing is getting yourself up and running with DFS. And for this tool, I'm actually going to go off and flip back to my 2008 box to do this and use good old-fashioned DFS management. So this is my DFS manager tool. What I'm going to do is I'm basically going to go in and take a look at each of the replications for each of those folders. And you can see here that currently 2008 FileServe 1 and FileServe 2 are listed as having a copy of these. In other words, they're abstracting it. I simply want to go in here and say right mouse click, say new member, hit browse, choose my 2012 file server 1, bring them in. It's going to go off and contact them. Come on.
Now again, as Rick mentioned, once we get to a more modern platform and we have abstracted out and virtualized this, you're not going to have to deal with moving this data like this. One of the great things I love about storage spaces is that the information about the disks in the storage stored on the disks.
Right.
So I could actually disconnect, move over, and reconnect. And it's just a matter of importing in that configuration. And then I've just moved my data to even a more modern platform there without having to worry about copying all of this data.
So it basically went ahead, it said, okay, you added a machine, I'll go off and contact it. Do I have the appropriate replication capabilities, same domain, trust relationship, that sort of stuff, it's all done. Which is your existing guy you want to use as your source? So I just choose one of them. Do I want to go off and have a specific schedule? I'm going to say replicate available all times. Do I want to go off and have the local representation someplace? I've pre-seeded the data, keep me synchronized, and then I choose under E Drive engineering. Hit OK. Next, go ahead and create the shared folder to make the share working correctly. Hit Create. It goes off and finishes with green check marks.
Now, the great thing about pre-seeding all of this data is if any new files and anything were created after we've done this pre-seeding, DFS is going to go ahead and take care of that replication.
Right.
So there's a lot of cases. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of cases where we know where that archive data is, that we can just move at random during the day and not have to worry about things. It's when we start getting into that, you know, current stuff, the 2014 2013, you know, expense report folder, for an example, that's constantly being updated, that it gets to be a little bit tricky. But this is where DFS really kind of helps, because we can pre-seed with all the data that we did at night, and then if anything was created in the overnight hours, it'll replicate over, so we're not having to move a ton of data. That's why I love leveraging DFS, not just for the namespace and making it simple for users and for us, but it makes it simple to get that data over.
Now I'm getting this bang warning message, simply warning you that, hey, FRS requires that you have access to DF2 Active Directory, and there's replication cycles that are going to be involved in this as well. So basically, simply warning you, make sure things coalesce and converge before you start going too much further. We've had experiences with that, so I'm just going to finish putting these guys all in here just to finish this off. So I got two more to go. I should know this name off by heart by now. 2012 file server one. Hit OK. Bring them in. I'm keeping the defaults to make it simple. Choosing the sales folder. Again, it's pre-seeded, which is nice. And then the last one.
So once Rick completes all of these stages, the next step is going to be probably bringing in another 2012 server, getting it configured, getting it pre-staged with the DFS data so that we have more than one replica, right? And then in this case, we may have a third location that we need to add. We're going to add the third one there. Then we'll start pulling out replication partners. So I wouldn't pull out any replication partners until you at least have your basics, right? Your absolute minimums that you require. And it's all dependent upon where your data is mostly accessed.
Yeah,
right?
Even if you only have one file server and you're a small environment, you still should be looking at using DFS as masking that server name, because having to migrate and maintain that server name is a pain in the butt. Definitely.
You don't want your end users calling saying, where's my E drive?
Yeah,
right?
Or else where's my whack file server 27 for my files, you know? You move them up to abstract this. Now this is all done. This has to basically replicate, make it all happy. This is also going to be using block level replication. So basically, if the files have not changed, the block level's the same on both sides, it's done. It's up to date. If there was a change in a paragraph of one of those files, only those changes of those paragraphs come across. That's one of the great things about DFSR that's out there. So these guys are now both done. Everything's good. And I would normally, I'm not going to save you the boring part, I would normally go through and add in the second server. I'm just going to add the one in for now.
Okay.
So he's now done. The last part is on 2012, this is my file server number one. I also have DFSR on here, management-wise. And he has not received, oh, look at that. That was fast. He actually knows about it.
Yeah.
I like that.
We upgraded the AD. It's all happy now.
That's true. Okay. And then I need to basically go in and simply say, add a namespace to display. I want to go in and show me the namespace for this guy. Currently, if I look at my Contoso.com namespace servers, I have two of them that are enabled, file server 1 and file server 2. Like before, I simply go in here and simply say, add a new namespace server, 2012 file server 1. He comes in, he'll replicate. Once he coalesces, go in, add a second one. When they replicate and they're all good, get rid of the other guys, and boom, you've just now completely transparently moved stuff around underneath your users' noses about the fact that it's now done. That is DFS migration. Done.
Awesome. All right. So now...
someone was asking about clusters.
Clusters.
With the 21 minutes left that we have in this particular session, I will say that there is a way better session that spends 75 minutes just on migrating clusters that happened yesterday with Jose Barreto and a bunch of other guys. I think PC guy was there as well, a bunch of other guys. So go catch that one online. I'll simplify it for you here in some slides. Basically, there is a 2008 R2 wizard interface that you can launch for Migrate a Cluster Wizard that'll go through and quite literally, keeping it simple, takes the content of your configuration of your highly available clustered resources, your VMs, your roles, that sort of stuff, exports them, takes them out, and saves them as another resource file, has a log about whether or not it was successful or not, and everything's all good. You then create a brand new cluster right next to it, And then you, once that guy's up and running, you can then run the second half of that, which imports that on the other side. But it doesn't point to any resources anywhere. What you then would do is you have to experience some downtime by disconnecting the resources from the cluster shared volume on the old guys over to the new guys, and then light it up and turn it on and basically take them online. So basically you take the cluster resources offline on the old one. Once all the resources are offline, you simply move the data, or more appropriately, reconnect the data to the new set of clusters, and then you then bring it back online again from a cluster perspective. That's the simplest Coles Notes form of what you would do. You can do an evaluation about whether or not you'd be successful or not using the Migrated Cluster Wizard, and take a look at the reports that come out of that as well.
Now, this is what I love, because migrating clusters is not something that I just want to haphazardly do. It's not something that I want to do to impact production.
Right.
So the great thing is that with this copy cluster wizard that we have, you can actually run it in a testing mode.
Right.
So you can do the entire thing without ever affecting any production, any customers. You're not moving any data either. All you're doing is going in and testing the configuration.
Right.
Right? So I can reverse it if I've got any problems. And it's a great way for me to be able to copy my configuration into a test environment prior to doing a migration.
Right. Biggest thing is being able to have access to the storage, and then being able to have a copy of that storage somehow on a separate alternate location so you don't damage the production stuff, obviously. So that's where, again, some SANs with duplication of data between two different SANs comes in quite handy to be able to do that. Cluster roles for wizard testing is there. The actual storage itself, it's assuming that your storage will be reused. It does not copy the data. It simply goes off and does the settings from the old into the new. And currently what's supported is your file server, physical disk, cluster registry settings, DFS namespace. Basically, all the stuff in white is the stuff that's supported with 2012. 2012 R2 includes some additional stuff for your Hyper-V virtualizers, sorry, your Hyper-V VMs, your scale-up file servers, your CSV disk, and also storage pools and storage spaces. So you need the more recent version of that cluster wizard to be able to get those yellow guys to be able to go up and to work.
More importantly, what's not supported?
So you got SQL, Exchange, print spoolers, desktop connection broker, DFSR, shadow copy, task scheduler tasks, and COW, or cluster aware updating. Those guys are not available to go through with that particular wizard. They'll flag in the file. You'll have to go through and basically reconstruct on the other side, or again, consult SQL, consult Exchange on the best way to go off and to do it.
We gave you the example of how we would reconstruct the DFSR here in this demo here.
You got it. It gives you a nice little report. Make sure you read them. Just like how you have the cluster validation wizard, that's the level of detail you get in this particular report, with little bangs if they're red, or warning signs if they're yellow that they could still progress, and green means good, or verde if you're in Spain.
Well done.
That was cluster migration. And then some last little bit. We already talked about this. Your server migration tools can be used for your local and group migration. They can be used if you needed to stick with the UNC name and wanted the old UNC name brought over to the new server. You can basically migrate the computer name, also IP address information as well. We did the robocopy because it's multi-threaded. This is not multi-threaded. And it also, again, can slow down if you have a large bulk of data that comes off of it. Rich copy, if you prefer a GUI, you can go and download it. And basically migration tools can degrade with performance. So we already did the robocopy. I jumped ahead for the demos, demo space. And that brings me up to this.
Uh-oh. you have 15 minutes.
Okay,
I
could easily fill up 75 minutes just talking about this alone. One of the really exciting things on Server 2012 is storage. And I'm, as you can probably tell, a big fan of the storage side of things. This is something that is enabled by this new technology in storage. With these technologies in 2012, there are some new capabilities of hardware configurations. Dell announced one at Tech in North America, the Vertex, I think they called it, which basically is a four-node cluster with shared disk that is able to be set up as a storage space that can be accessed by all four of those nodes, and it can be set up as a VDI solution, it can be set up as a scale-up file server, it can be set up as a virtualization solution, all in one box that weighs about 80 kilos, I think. Literally, it's heavy. It's out there. Because what they're doing is we basically made the spec. Here's how the architecture of software works inside this box. The original device manufacturers, or ODMs, took this and basically put two nodes fully redundant inside a single piece of tin. 2U, 4U, whatever it happens to be for the sizes. I have one that I have back at my office, which is by a company called Quanta. And I just got a new one, if you want to see what this actually looks like, by a company called DataON. So literally, inside one 2U form factor, this is what's known as their DNS9220, a 12-drive array at the front of shared SAS disk, of whatever speed and size disk that you want. They are connected through a standard JBOD connection over the network to both of those nodes on the left and the right-hand side. And then those nodes on the left and right-hand side, obviously, are your CPU, memory, and disk controllers to talk to the shared SAS. And then this guy is a prime target to be able to set up and work as a cluster in a box using scale-up file server or using tiered storage with R2 or using a Hyper-V node that's out there. The bigger manufacturers, these guys are hungry. The DataON guys are hungry to be able to get some penetration and stuff. Great for branch offices, great for dentist offices, lawyers' offices where they want high availability, but they don't want a SAN. They don't want fiber channel cards, right? Instead, they have it all inside one box. Dell, HP, and others are announcing them. Dell just released theirs a little while ago. It's pre-wired, simple. How simple is it? You can have a cluster in a box up and running, and I've done it, and it's recorded, and you can take a look at it, in 28 and a half minutes. Done. Simplest cluster you've ever seen. It's amazing. It's on channel9.msdn.com.
That was not using the i7000.
That was not the i7000. That's the real one. And I talk all the way through it with a friend of mine called Graham about how that works. Literally, it is, you take the box, you lace it up with power, you plug in the green cable into the green slot, the blue cable into the blue slot as far as your network is concerned. You talk to them about the specs. And then you boot it up with a KVM, and then you take a look at it, one node, and that becomes your primary node. You fill out a wizard interface that walks you through the cluster initialization, cluster creation. It even will go through, if you don't have a domain, and do a domain DC promo for you as well. If you do have a domain, you simply join into it. And then, lickety-split, barber trick, you've got yourself a cluster in a box. Awesome stuff. All because of Server 2012, because of storage spaces, and also hardware manufacturers that are going off and making these things. So these things are great. Absolutely awesome. Look at that. I did that in less than 5 minutes.
That's impressive. That's impressive.
So where do these guys actually kind of fit? So at the lower end of the spectrum, you've got simply direct attached storage coming through with SAS or with SATA drives that are directly attached to your individual single node servers. At the high end, you've got your scale-out file server cluster. You've got storage arrays. You've got SAN and fiber channel. Right in the middle is where these guys, cluster in your box guys, happens to sit. This brings up an interesting conversation that I had with one of the gentlemen that's downstairs that runs the hands-on labs. He's a friend of mine. And he used to have and still has a very fast fiber channel SAN that he uses. But instead of having his 50 or 60 Hyper-V nodes that's used for virtualization, each with two fiber channel cards talking to that individual SAN, he's now replaced it with a scale-up file server. And he's looking at possibly augmenting that scale-up file server with cluster in a box talking with fiber channel up to the individual fiber channel guys instead. Great solution. What does it give you? Well, he's now eliminated over 100 fiber channel cards he no longer needs to replace on his Hyper-V boxes. They now talk over 10 gig E Ethernet to the SMB file share, which is now served out by the scale-up file server, and they now have access to the file share where all the VHDX files are to be able to have access to it. That also gives them the ability to have multiple sessions, SMB3, redundant capabilities of if one node goes down on the scale-up file server, the other node simply picks it right back up again without losing connectivity to your drives. So you can reuse those investments you have with the SAN, front-end it with Server 2012 with fiber channel cards, making a cluster. Cluster in a box is one other example of what you could use with it.
So it kind of fits like right in between that expertise dollar amount and it allows the flexibility, not just a lot of times. We kind of get stuck, and I know this because I actually went from a large enterprise down to a small mid-sized business. We kind of get stuck in this, oh, we don't really have enterprise-class services in small to mid-sized businesses. This is a perfect place for this technology to go in there.
I'd still get fired by the guy if it wasn't working. So
yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly. But it gives you room to grow to the more modern technologies.
Yeah. So like yourselves, I literally just got access to the R2 bits last week. And so in the next 12 minutes, I'll be turning off my laptop to be able to get R2 onto there because I can't wait to try out some of the stuff with tiered storage and other things along those lines with Server 2012. Likewise as well, I'm looking forward to getting back to my office where I'll have access to some of these new cluster-in-a-box technologies. I strongly suggest you take a look at them as an option. As an architect, before I joined Microsoft, trying to architect a highly available solution was a huge pain. You had to know a lot of stuff. It's like a black art of fiber. It was crazy to know how to set up the fiber channels and LUNs and drives and stuff like that. It was not easy. And then having to do that on a per component basis. Now you can simply drop in a 2U server, boom, 30 minutes, you got a cluster up and running, and you got resources being shared off of it.
Excellent.
With that.
So let's wrap up. Over the last three sessions
you got
here.
It. And a bonus one if you go back and take a look at North America.
Yeah, absolutely. So you'll see here, this is where you can go get these sessions. So if you missed any of our crazy rebuilding, upgrading, migrating, moving stuff, getting current, you can go back and watch that. Again, Rick's mentioned it's channel9.msdn.com. Go to events, Tech Ed Europe. You should find it there. We've gone from an environment of 2003 domain controller. There's a couple other 2003 servers handling DHCP. We had a 2008 domain controller in there. We had a 2008 file server. We had some data. We've kind of shown you how you can actually move this stuff. Now, in our example, yeah, we didn't bring great big huge enterprise class, you know, thousands of DHCP scopes with hundreds of thousands of leases and terabytes of data. But what we're showing you is how easy it is to get current using tools that are in the box. There are other tools out there that can help in continuing to push forward if you've invested in some of those tools. But this is a really great way for you to kind of start thinking about getting current, because you're not going to be able to drive that business forward, as I talked about in the last session, and to really innovate until we get to this current platform. And the other thing, too, I think it's been made pretty clear through the discussions in both keynotes, as well, if you paid any attention to what's been going on in San Francisco at the Build event, that things are innovating quicker. The technology, the hardware is innovating quicker. They're asking, customers are asking us, industry is demanding that we increase our cadence as well. So really to kind of keep up and really do that innovation, take advantage of the technologies that we talked about here, you've really got to get current. We've laid that kind of foundational groundwork and showed you the tools that we have in the box to get you started today.
It brings up an interesting conundrum. It used to be that you would say, this is my desktop standard. This is my server standard across the board when you had the budget to be able to do off and do projects. We're going to have to work with this accelerated cadence of now simply choosing, for this project, this is the version that I'm going to use. For the next project that's 8 months down the road, this is the version that I'm going to use. And then this is the version I'm going to use. And then you've got our commitment. We're going to make it as easy as possible for you to move through that sliding window of where those products happen to be. And that's, again, something that's foreign to the way that we like to work as IT pros, resisting change and trying to simplify things. I will ask you once again, first of all, thank you for sticking out for three of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate it, man. Evals are extremely important. Evals don't count unless there's at least 15 of them as far as our internal numbers are concerned. So please, be nice, be kind, give us evals. Most importantly, though, is the comments area to give us criticisms and also constructive criticisms on what we could do better, what type of sessions you like to see, if this is a type of session you like to see. We need to know that for planning purposes. And obviously, we're a little, you know, competitive, so we like to have good scores as well, like anybody else.
Sure.
So let us know. We really appreciate you guys staying here for so long. We have 6 minutes left, and so we're not going anywhere. If you'd like to continue to stay and to have a conversation about migration to storage, Active Directory, you want to go off and beat 6 minutes out of the next batch of people that are going to be leaving, you're more than welcome to. But Joey and I are here to take any questions you might have. We do have one microphone and a very eager person to run it around if she has any questions you want to ask. But thank you very much for staying with us so far.
Thanks for your time, and have a safe trip back.